We'll begin with, this is Mae Bressel on KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California. It's broadcast number 616, and it is September 26, 1983. Still 83, 2 months till 83 is over, and that goes very, very fast this time of year. There's so many things to do. I saw an article in the San Francisco Examiner this last week, just of interest to me. It may not. Some of you have records or copies of reports that I did. I did two tapes on things that had happened to our family or close calls, and some that were worse than close calls. And somehow or other, there's a little bit of bad luck or scariness going around close to the family. It always touches the edge of it. It was an article in the San Francisco Examiner about a play, Let My People Come. And my daughter was in that play last year for a year, and she toured on the Road Company. It was in New York off Broadway for a while. And then she did the Road Company in Chicago and where was she? Toronto and back east. They, three different cities back, and they traveled. And I read that the fellow who did the musical directing for the off-Broadway production and did the piano work for the play was confined to a mental hospital this week up in the Oakland area, and the girlfriend that he had had for quite a few years had put him in there, and she claimed that he had a personality change. She moved out here about a year ago and was interested in doing anti-war demonstrations or writing an anti-war opera. They write music, and was very interested in the peace movement. And her boyfriend got very crazy, and he developed these multiple personalities. I don't know at what point he got them, but he was Mr. X, and he was Ed Saunders, which is the name of the fellow who wrote The Family, the Manson story. And then he used the name Sweeney, and I thought of Dennis Sweeney. And he changed personalities and was going to cut Ellen up into pieces and put her on a beach and had hallucinations. And it was really scary because this guy has a capacity for doing this thing, and they put him in a hospital for 6 months. And I asked my daughter if he behaved this way on the road, and she said, well, he was reading some literature that I guess you would interpret as being violent, and it was a little bit disturbing. And she mentioned that he did have trouble, and that she had sent Ellen had asked her for some money, I believe, to help him with the, I guess, the psychiatric care, which is very dangerous when you step in and help somebody, and if they know you lock them up, they sometimes come back, and this is something that could be very dangerous. And I was concerned because when the girls were in the play down here at the Barnyard, Dean Selmayr was there. Many of you probably remember that. And Dean was an actor. He was in the play Little Tiny Alice in New York. And Dean was involved with the CIA. They used him for mind control and medical experiments. And he was wrote a book called Blow Away. I mentioned that once on a program. And he tells how he put people up on meat hooks and so forth. And he was arrested once, and the CIA wanted him to do some assassinations. So if he would do the murders, he wouldn't go to jail. And the CIA is very good at getting murders done. That's horrendous. A lot of people don't know that part of our government, that the assassinations are done by people who have past crimes, and they're used by the agencies, and you wonder sometimes why a certain person is murdered and another person is disappearing in the stage or cinema or public life. But this particular person, Dean Selmayr, was one of these who was doing work for the agency. And this other person that Barbara toured around with for a year was now having these multiple personalities and wanted to cut Ellen up in little pieces and put her in a box. I just mentioned that because it reappears, you think, when your kids have professions and they're out on the road that they're safe or something, but I guess no one is really safe from this Central Intelligence Agency when they have these kinds of people around. I mentioned last week that when I was in Los Angeles and when I got my was the Washington Post, there was a large article, looked like an article, it was an advertisement, Larry Flint on the Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Flight 007. And there was something that I liked about the article, and that was that in the attempt to explain alternatives to what the media was throwing out about the tragic airplane that went down over the Soviet Union. It was at least an alternate view of studying history, and that's what I've tried to do with my broadcast, and I learned it when I began studying the John Kennedy assassination. You just don't zoom in on November 22nd, 1963. There are events that preceded these murders when they're major political assassinations, and there are events that follow afterwards that precede the next major tragedy. And they're escalated on a certain regularity, as many of you have noticed, from every few months some major scene comes that can be pinpointed to the CIA. And, of course, this, I believe, is one of them. And this article, it's not an article, it's a paid ad, a full page, goes back to the history of the United States and how we always proclaimed our innocence with the sinking of the Maine. And we tried to blame the Spanish-American War, and the Spanish weren't to blame. And then the Lusitania that was blown up in World War II, and innocent people on that boat, and actually it was filled with a lot of gunpowder. And then the war in South Korea, which actually wasn't necessary at all. And then it's a real full story with a bibliography of about 10 important books to read on American history. And it goes into Vietnam and the Gulf of Tonkin incident and Gary Powers and the U-2 flight and how we provoke the Soviet Union. We set off these incidences and then we cry and yell about how abusive they are. And the point of this particular long essay, I guess the best word is essay, is how the CIA has goaded the Soviet Union for such a long time and sending their spy planes and denying it is a plane and then admitting it is and trying to cover up such a series of provocations that how can you believe, for example, that even flying over the Soviet Union isn't one more provocation. And this essay goes on to say by the 1970s, the citizens heard so many lies and deceptions that they lost their innocence. I think they lost their innocence gradually along the way, and certainly by the 70s and through the Vietnam War period. And then as of September last year, Reagan's rhetoric was beginning to threaten people. Well, that started right with his inauguration and his address and Richard Pipes and Alexander Haig and all of them throwing these terrible statements out against the Soviet Union. So that Richard Nixon has been threatening these people, when September the 1st came, 1983, and the Korean airline went down, he was saying, what you tell us is lies. This is the cruelest thing we've ever heard. And the adjectives are something that really should be studied over the years, just as there are many books on the Vietnam War. I think this is a stepping stone to the next war. It's been planned since 1943, and we're getting closer to it now. They don't even blush or apologize. Now, I noticed that Ronald Reagan appeared to be a little more mild, and there was suddenly a ceasefire, an agreement over in Lebanon to sit down with the Syrians. I'm wondering if the Soviet Union has parts of the airplane that they are holding. You see, if it was a spy plane, they can do two things. They can either publicly show that the President of the United States is lying, which they seldom do, whether it has to do with the Kennedy assassination or Vietnam or a lot of the episodes that were involved in the secret, so-called secret bombing of Cambodia that they knew was no secret. So they can do one of two things. They can either proclaim that we are liars, or they can hold it as a bargaining card and get a slowdown on the war process. And I'm wondering, because of Ronald Reagan's complete 180-degree change when he went to the United Nations before all of these people, and he knows most of them think he's a fool, I'm wondering if the Soviet Union didn't have something. They were going to return parts of the airplane today or tomorrow to the Japanese and the Koreans, and I'm wondering if they're going to return parts of the spy equipment, and then that's a way of saying, now, shut up, and it would bring down the war fever. I think the only thing that would bring down the war fever is to catch us at lies and prohibit our escalating it. You know, if we do overtly things like the U-2 or if this was a spy plane, and then they have the proof, we have to back down and behave in a more civilized way than if we hold all the trump cards. Well, this essay on the 007 was refreshing because it goes into the provocations that we do and asks, who would we believe? And then Larry Flynt says, I'm suspicious of a man like McDonald because he's so nuts and his martyrdom can't be ruled out as a motive. I don't think he wanted to be martyred. I don't think anyone wants to go that way, but I don't think he knew it was going down. He had no control of the instrument panels, and he had no way of knowing. He didn't blow up the plane. If he blew up the plane and blamed the Soviet Union, but I don't think he had any way of knowing the plane would go down. I agree that he's weird, and I believe that there was hanky-panky. I also believe that there was mind control on the part of the pilots, as I said before, and that they didn't care if they went down because they didn't have a choice. Now, speaking of Larry McDonald, there was something I wanted to share with you that I hadn't had on the air yet, because Western Goals is that computerized organization that has the Los Angeles Police Department files that were stolen, and there is a lot of talk about computerized data on individuals and citizens that could be used for very dangerous purposes later. And last year, just about a year ago, I talked about the Reagan administration sending back to Nazi Germany 10.7 million members of the Nazi, their membership cards, and 600,000 of the SS police files and 400,000 of the stormtroopers, so that they can go about, again, checking genealogy and finding out who to use for particular public office and businesses. Well, when I was down in Los Angeles, Charles Higham got some documents from the powers that be in Washington on Klaus Barbie and the Ryan investigation. And one of the things he got was a paper from the CIC operations, that's the intelligence, the counterintelligence operation, dated December 15th, 1946. The war was over 6 months earlier, May 1945. This was dated December the 14th, 1946, a top secret report on an operation called Red Lilac Organization. This was the British use of the Nazis, and they had former members of the SS and former members of the SD, and it tells how they set up small organizations. Now, this is with the CIA, and this is with the Nazis, and this is part of American document, and they were going to send their jewels and their money to the Russian zone, but one of the things they wanted was the compiled list of foreign estates that were used to hide National Socialists before 1933. So what they wanted was documentation on people who helped them before Hitler even came to power. That is old Nazi. We used to talk about old money or new money. That is old, old Nazi before 1933. So when World War II was over, they were already concerned with collecting the documentation of families that went back that put Adolf Hitler in power and survived. I guess he got rid of the ones he didn't want. So the ones that put him in power and survived, they were collecting those documents with the help of the United States Army, and that is the weird thing about it. Now, the Communist Party had an article about the 007, Flight 007, in People's World, and I hear so much from the think tanks like Richard Pipes and Ernest Lefevre and the Buckleys and all the thrashing around that, you do have to read once in a while the other side, and I take People's World, and this is what Gus Hall had to say about Flight 007. This is September 24th, so that's almost 3 weeks later. Never in the course of presidential history have so many bombastic words, such an orgy of demagogic self-righteousness and war rhetoric, been spewed out from the White House in such a short time with such total media orchestration. Now, that is what frightened me, frankly, was the orchestration and the way it went. And he says, this well-planned and manipulated attempt to create an atmosphere of hysteria has all the destructive characteristics of the cover-up for a crime, and it includes a series of fabrications and a total refusal to answer questions that would obviously reveal the crime. How could a jet liner with sophisticated navigation equipment that was in constant contact with U.S. and Japanese and South Korea ground controllers, even tracked by a U.S. space satellite, get lost? Now, many of these questions you've seen in your newspapers, and I won't run them all down, but the main point is that he asks the pertinent questions in this 2.5-hour period. Why didn't the Japanese, the United States and the South Koreans monitor urgently, use the monitors, and advise the plane, as well as the Soviet officials, of what they were doing. They didn't tell the Soviets that they were a commercial airline in case they didn't know it or not. The Soviet Union had the means and the right to bring down the spy plane by air and ground-to-air missiles as soon as it violated their airspace. Instead, they tried for 2.5 hours to communicate with the plane. They call this a Korean spy provocation, which the Reagan administration is doing, and the Korean authorities don't even answer the question. They were flying over U.S. military installations at the dead of night with no navigation lights and totally unresponsive to requests for identification. This is a crude attempt to discredit and slander the Soviet Union in order to divert the anti-Reagan demonstrations to exploit and put down the U.S. peace movement, to start the anti-Soviet direction and take the heat off the United States government. They said the hysterical rhetoric of the media is an attempt to label the Soviet Union inhuman, dishonest, brutal, filled with lack of integrity, barbarism, a massacre, bloody, fascist, military dictatorship. This is what they're calling the Soviet Union. They're using these words. And the article goes on to ask, well, what is the reverse of this story, why this crude attempt to cut off travel, culture exchange, and so forth, and to plan the U.S. deployment of missiles. There were a list of motives. I told you I'd bring them in. I could have brought them in tonight. I'll bring them next week. But I think the explanation of how the week began is very important. As I say, it was frightening because people are such followers. If they're not followers, I don't hear their anger at the way the language was spoken by the president. And he asked, in the course of this presidential history, have you ever heard anything, you know, so ugly and so self-righteous? And that's what it was. Luckily for Ronald Reagan, he has the kind of little smile that if he just smiles and grins, people forget it. I don't know how he has that art of that actor in him or the ham to simply woo them over and they forget what he said yesterday. He can come on today like the peace lover, and yesterday he was the warmonger. He's the United Nations. He wants to be the international statesman. Now, I won't comment too much on James Watt statement. I thought was so disgusting. I wish he'd get out. Richard Viguerie, V-I-G-U-E-R-I-E, is the fellow who's pushing to keep him in and tells him to stay. He's one of the most loyal members of your administration. Richard Viguerie worked very hard with Reverend Moon and with Larry McDonald, and he's part of the Birch Society, the Young Americans for Freedom, and the Right Wing. And he has these big mailing lists that help people like James Watts, to get support so that Reagan is looking for answers. Viguerie has these mailing lists so he can get an instant computer out and get letters to all these people saying, hold Watts. So when Viguerie wants Watts, he can write more letters than my listeners can and or any of the other people listening to talk shows or radio programs or TV. So James Watts, I guess, can stay there and insult anybody and do anything he wants. It seems to be that way. John DeLorean gave himself a lie detector test to prove that he was innocent. This is so funny. I just put this on for laughs because here he was holding all this cocaine and said it's pure gold and his eyes are lusting after it. But he gave himself a polygraph test. It was given by David Raskin, the University of Utah psychologist, and he said that he passed it. The lie test proves that he's innocent because he passed the test, which shows that he wasn't going to deal in the drugs. He was just holding it and cradling it, but he was going to deal in it. That reminded me of the lie detector test that Jack Ruby had when he insisted he had it for the Warren Commission. And they said, are you a law-abiding citizen? He passed that. Yeah, I'm law-abiding. You know, are you honest? Am I American citizen? Yeah, you know, law-abiding American citizen. He kept adding, he shot a man handcuffed in the police department, but he passed the test that he was a law-abiding citizen. I don't know what law that is, but he passed it. There were rumors, I don't know if they're true or not, about Richard Nixon planning to take Korean Airline 007. This was published in Germany. It was repeated out of TASS. Richard Nixon isn't saying anything. It would be natural if he went down to South Korea. Reverend Moon always came to his rescue when he was in trouble at the time of Watergate. And he was close to Tongson Park in the Korean CIA. It would be natural that he'd go down there for the 30th anniversary of his celebration in South Korea, the government there, in the end of their war that America helped them have with North Korea. But There hasn't been much on that. It would be an interesting twist if he was about to go there and ditch out. It would be sort of like his being at the Murchison's home the night before Kennedy was killed and being at the airport the day Kennedy was killed and then getting out of Dallas before the blood spilled. There are a lot of good articles on the Korean airline. There's so many, I'm just absolutely exhausted cutting the newspapers this past week. There's so many articles, good ones, on problems with the airplane or interesting aspects of the airplane, and I've broken them down into massive files. But there's some speculation, some good stories. One, they may have triggered the plane's destruction. The pressure on the Soviet military machine may have triggered the destruction. The interesting thing about this article is it said we send fly planes over all the time, and that the Soviet Union believes that we could begin an invasion at any time over their country. And that's why they're nervous. Isn't that terrible? It says they have the men there have a sustained state of stress based on the U.S. planes and fighter bomber tests and sometimes penetrating their airspace from Alaska and the Japanese bases. And that causes them to get trigger happy because they're sure that we're going to drop bombs and invade them. There was another article in the San Francisco Examiner. Jetliner pilot boasted of CIA spy missions. And it tells how this same pilot, Chun Bing, B-Y-U-N-G, Bing, the one who flew for the president of South Korea, was a colonel in the reserves of the South Korean Air Force. And he told his friends he showed them a special spy equipment and cameras that he puts on the plane and uses for surveying the Soviet military objects. That same flight from New York to South Korea that he does spying, and he works, takes these pictures, and then under secret agreement, he uses a Korean airline, the commercial plane. He gives them to the CIA. That was published this week. It came out of Moscow, AP Wire Service. And he said that the Boeing airplane, the one that was originally built, and five McDonnell Douglas DC-10s and so forth, among others, have the spying equipment. They have the aircraft manufacturers in America fixed them up with the spying equipment. So that would explain why they're a little bit nervous about an airplane being over their territory for 2 hours. I also wonder if there was a chance of a drop, if any people were dropped behind the line, the spy line, that evening with so many, the 135, that spy plane, and the commercial airline, the satellite. There's a lawsuit filed in New York just this morning, a $1 billion claim against Federal Aviation. A woman, Betty Lim, is suing because of the death of her husband. She's suing the United States government on the grounds that the Flight 007 deliberately entered the Soviet airspace with the knowledge of the United States government. And she's also suing Litton Industry and the Boeing airline. So you see, when all the yelling is over and people have to go to court and show why that machinery didn't function and break the financial back of some of these companies, maybe they'll stop playing so many games because it really gets to be expensive to pull that kind of thing. Here's another story. The Soviets say the Korean airliner was a cog in an elaborate spying mission. Many of you may have heard that. It came from the LA Times that simultaneously we had three things going at one time. One was a complicated U.S. intelligence mission with reconnaissance satellite. And then the Korean airline deliberately flew over the Soviet territory as the American reconnaissance satellite programmed to pass overhead at the same time recorded the electronic traffic and whereabouts of the air defense systems because they were activated to meet a presumed threat. That one plane went out of Anchorage, Alaska, and this spy plane that they identified as a spy plane, and it was alongside of this. So when it went back, this one was there. And by using the satellite above, you could tell where they were following and what they were doing so that it gets a little more complicated. Another article in the New York Times, Soviet says 747 used tricks like a spy plane, and it tells how they were frustrating Soviet air defense and lowering their flaps as if they're in pursuit and slipping away and going below a radar cover, and the RC-135 had dived below the radar area and was testing them and the activities on the peninsula there that they weren't supposed to be seeing. And this tells how the 747 was playing along with it and doing various kinds of operations for testing, I guess, or for annoying the pilots and goading them to shoot. Didn't think they would while they're taking pictures, but they did go ahead and they shot the plane down anyway. Another story, Soviet seems unwilling to bar future downing. They said, we will not say that we will not shoot down commercial airlines. And this is very important. The Soviet response to Western pressure for guarantees came last week where, this is a quotation, some people in Washington have gone to the lengths of declaring that the United States should elaborate norms of conduct of world airspace and take action that will almost amount to assuming control over the air corridors existing in various countries. The commentary said Washington's imperial ambitions are, of course, an open secret, but is there a limit to everything, gentlemen? Regardless of what you think, every time they go over the sovereignty of each state, it is our own particular property, they said. And they pointed out that the United States would like to own all of the airways. And that's pretty scary because I see another article I have here on the Navy wanting to control all the water to isolate the Soviet Union and blaming John Lehman. Now, he's a fellow I've talked about a lot on the different broadcasts, the cousin of Princess Grace, the late Princess Grace, but the Kelly family from Philadelphia. And he is very powerful. He and his two brothers work with Henry Kissinger, Fritz Kramer, and one of them works a liaison to the Vatican. They're very close to the Pope. And John Lehman has been causing a lot of trouble wanting to enlarge the fleet and get 600 ships. And he's very open. He's the one member of the cabinet who's very open about declaring war against the Soviet Union. And there was an article, The Triangle, that I got this week on alleging that John Lehman was behind the shooting down of the 007 or was responsible. And it's pretty interesting because, as I say, I finger this guy all of the time for his various espionage and provocative acts and also his relationship to John Tower and the powers that be in Washington, his other nightlife or the other side of John Lehman. This article says, when all the facts concerning the airlines, the Korean Airlines flight, 007 come to light, one particular individual in the Reagan administration is likely to emerge a major culprit in the death of 609 people. For as we sift through the material of September 1st, an outline of design, what the Soviets are calling the provocation, begins to take shape, a design the Reagan administration has spent 3 years carefully preparing. The design is the brainchild of John Lehman, Reagan's maniacal anti-Soviet Secretary of Navy, a man cut from the same cloth as National Security Advisor William Clark and United Nations Ambassador Gene Kirkpatrick. Known around Washington as the Lehman Doctrine and in defense circles as the horizontal escalation, the design fits too closely to the September 1st events to be dismissed as a simple coincidence. It would go a long way toward explaining why Fly 007 was hundreds of miles off course and what it was up to. To most people, the key finish point for any confrontation between the Soviet Union and the USA would be Europe. But for the past year and a half, John Lehman has been working out a strategic nuclear problem. What few people realize is that the second largest concentration of U.S. nuclear and conventional firepowers is the North Pacific, and the fact is closely tied to the major concern of U.S. global strategy in the Middle East. In the last week, leading up to this incursion and the intelligence operations in the area of overflight were particularly aggressive efforts of the Soviet Union to show off and use some of their missiles. On a number of occasions, the United States surveillance, the RC-135, probed the Soviet defenses while the U.S. surface ships skirted the edge of the Soviet territorial waters in the Sea of Okhotsk, O-K-H-O-T-S-K. On the night of August 31st to September 1st, the night the plane went down, seven different flights recorded by RC-135s were in the area. They were recorded. The Soviets have challenged the United States and Japan to release the full tape transcripts of the 2.5 hours of communication between the Soviet fighter pilots because the communication might show the relationship of the Korean air flights to the RC-135. The administration is keeping quiet so far. The evidence is steadily mounting that the flight was not off its course. It was right on course. What is not clear is why the Koreans, Japanese, and United States thought they could get away with it. Maybe they thought it was a good gamble. Then again, maybe they knew they couldn't get away with it. The lives of 269 is pretty cheap when you have to handle Lebanon, Central America, the MX, arms control on the front pages. Too horrible to contemplate anyone making such a decision. John Lehman is arguing for a policy of preemptive attack on the Soviets from the North Pacific. He's been talking about this for a long time. He said that we would enjoy tremendous tactical advantage if we would have a fire first in the North Pacific. John Layman has been testing this as an idea of escalation in the North Pacific. As current Pacific Command Chief Admiral Wong recently told the Japanese media, this region, I believe, is most probably where we shall first witness a confrontation with the Soviet Union. The Layman Doctrine, according to the man who created it, calls for achievement of outright maritime superiority over any power that might attempt to prevent our loss of the sea and maintain our vital interests worldwide. Isn't that a little scary and disgusting, you know, to think that they're talking, this is where we're going to hit first? While controlling the exit points of the Soviet Union's fleet for the various fleets are nothing new to U.S. military strategists, what is now new is Layman's aggressive confrontational approach and the establishment of an alliance system. The United States decides to engage in direct military intervention in the area. The only serious challenge would be the Soviet Mediterranean fleet and down in the lines of communication at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. Now, this may be why President Ronald Reagan is going to have a ceasefire in Lebanon and get Libya and Lebanon to work along with us on that plan. It says that we need to be secure in the Middle East before we do this. Under Prime Minister Yoshihiro Nakasone, the Japanese increased their arms spending 7%, and they go along with this. They're putting money into weapons, a far cry from what they intended to do many years ago. This article goes into the detailed planning. This is from People's World, September the 17th, 1983, naming John Layman. I've, as I say, fingered him for a bully who could get us into tremendous trouble. As time goes on, I don't know where these people come from. There's three of them, three brothers, and they had that Abington Corporation with various defense contractors and sold them weapon systems, and then he became Secretary of the Navy. He is really dead set on having war with the Soviet Union, and I think he believes he can do it soon, and that's what he wants to do. And this person has a copy, I guess, of the Layman Doctrine and seems to agree with it. There was another story, strained planes blamed on human errors. And they're trying to say that if this plane went off its route, this was a human error because the pilots gave it incorrect information. Well, that would go along again with a kamikaze or a sabotage type of operation. The pilots gave it the wrong information into the equipment, and the pilot crews were complacent. Because of the equipment's reliability, complacency is a very big problem because they get tired on the job. We'll take a one-minute break now, and, oh, it's past the half hour, and then go back to the other side of World Watchers.